Hello, everyone. My name is Jacob Minnig. I am the host of the Behavior Health Integration Podcast. Today, we have two very special guests, Richard O'Bannon and Michael Thornhill. Today, we are going to take a very deep dive into the world of psychedelics and how they could be used as therapeutic and spiritual interventions. Again, I just want to thank both you gentlemen for being here, too. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, awesome.
Launch. It's launch, Jake. Oh.
All right, Jacob, Richard, nice to see you both. Pleasure to be here. So, Jacob, it's a pleasure to come back and connect with you again. Thanks for connecting with me the first time around. So, just flowing into today, what we just briefly discussed before recording, looking at the trauma underneath the root cause of addiction. So, I think this is the first thing to outline, and I think many people are aware of this, but addiction is not the problem itself. The addiction is a symptom of many other issues, underlying issues, many cases, traumas, and it can be societal, collective, personal, familial, ancestral, karmic, whatever it may be. But the topic that we're going to start talking about today is like, what is the root cause of addiction? And from my perspective, in my own life, it was repressed, undiscovered trauma. And I thought there was something wrong with me. Because what happens if you're addicted to substances or other things like that, but especially substances, especially illegal substances, even more so than alcohol, even more so than cigarettes or coffee or work. But if you're addicted to illegal substances, there's such a stigma that comes. And this is the story that came for me was you're a bad person. You're a waster. And from that, I derived that there's something wrong with me, which then continues the spiral of feeling even more separate from love, separate from a family. And nowhere along the line is anyone saying, I wonder why this kid is turned into substances. And it seemed like in my family that the theme was, there's something wrong with this person. We should distance him and we should shame him. We should make him feel more guilty about that. But I think Gabor Marti has been such a great pioneer of taking that frame of looking at what the trauma is at the root cause of addiction. And for me, I think it's just a great conversation because I think there's still people out there through no fault of anyone's, because it's not a mainstream narrative still, that what is the root cause of addiction and how can we start treating the root cause of addiction by looking at the underlying trauma rather than continuing to put on top of it antidepressants and continuing to numb. And again, nothing wrong with antidepressants in themselves, and they can be very beneficial for people through a stage of a process, but it's not the end goal. It's not the solution. It can be a temporary solution to help people bridge that gap to be able to look at the root cause. So I think that's how I'll open. I'm just open to anyone else's thoughts here.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up Gabor Mate. He's been such a huge influence in the realm of addiction. And like you said, trying to understand the underlying cause. Him and Dr. Carl Hart have been instrumental, and to a large extent, Bessel van der Kolk as well. I should also note that all three of them are involved in this psychedelic renaissance that's currently happening in our society. Because as they have worked with their expertise, they have learned that psychedelic substances open up a realm that is not necessarily viewed on the outside. I guess if you want to get into the whole idea of holotropic states, that's also an important thing. Expanded window of tolerances, if we're going to use language that comes from a therapeutic context. I think it's very important to understand that, as our society and culture is developing in the 21st century, we're losing this idea of meaning, purpose, and belonging in our society. And these sacred substances, these sacred plant medicines, are allowing us to access realms within us from a holistic framework that are otherwise cut off by a lot of the things that we experience in our society. A huge part of that is things like social media. It's toxic. It's very toxic. And as we are relying more and more on our technology, we are separating ourselves, kind of like islands in an ocean, and it becomes very lonely. So therefore, we have to ask ourselves, you know, where do I derive my meaning, purpose, and belonging in the world from? And I think it's just important that we, I mean, I know Jake, I know Michael, I know you guys have mentioned this, but it really comes down to this idea of coping mechanisms that we derive from a lot of these substances and behaviors. I don't think trauma is necessarily always indicative of addiction, but there definitely is hurt. There's definitely hurt and pain that comes with it from not knowing where you're going to go, not knowing where your life is going to head. And then that's not even taken into consideration things like socioeconomic status. I mean, what about BIPOC communities that don't may not have access to a lot of these things? It's like that's the big problem in the psychedelic community in of itself right now, is we trying to attract BIPOC communities inside of it when, you know, there are millions of BIPOC people in jail for things as simple as cannabis conviction. I mean, which road do you want to go down on this? I mean, it's appalling.
Yeah, I think one from what you've just shared there, the first thing that was coming up is this idea of social media. And for us, my wife and I, we deleted our social media accounts about 2 years ago, and it was probably one of the single most healthiest things that we did for ourselves. And it was also kind of like jumping off a cliff, because society tells you that, like, oh, you're connected to everyone on social media. And what I've realized and recognized through not being on social media is that you're not connected to people by being on social media. It's actually the opposite. It's an actual illusion of connection and a superficial level of relationships, which continue to perpetuate this feeling of isolation and aloneness whilst you're still kind of trying to get that validation from the outside whilst feeling further and further disconnected. And I feel like I've had a lot of interactions with people over the last months. And I don't know whether this is related to social media directly, but I do on some level think that people have lost the ability to communicate directly, face to face, in direct messaging, being able to respond, to be accountable, to show up. And it seems like it's become normal for people, this term ghosting has come up a few times, excuse me. And just, it's just this interaction that we have. It just, it's digitalized and meaningless. And we don't know where to turn. And in many of these senses and situations, because especially over the last couple of years and becoming more and more isolated, people have leaned upon social media to try and get this meaning of validation and fulfillment. And I think it's failing short. And I do think that more and more people are beginning to see that, and more people are seeing that it's just reinforcing negative belief patterns. So that's the first thing that came up about what you shared. And I think I'll just leave that there. See if you've got anything else to add to that, because I don't want to just jump a topic, because I think this is a good one.
And I do. I actually have many, many roads that we can go down, many paths. But I, you know, the thing that comes to mind is, I guess, really haven't talked about it. I'm not really sure if we've talked about it in the past on the podcast, Jake, but it's the universality that we feel underneath these holotropic states that we have with these plant teachers. Michael, did you want to talk about what you experienced? You want to talk about, because Jake, I'm just going to guess that you may have not ever participated with a lot of these substances, and that's correct. Totally fine. It's not for everybody. That's I don't want to make a generalization.
But I would like to. That's the thing, is actually I'm interested in it.
Sure. So I guess from my perspective, and Michael, if you want to lead on this, but it's the feeling of connectedness that you get that is inside of these states that is transcends what we can describe with language. And I know that on past podcasts, I've talked about the need for language and within a therapeutic context, especially when a lot of these people come to counselors and they want to share these kind of experiences. And these counselors may not have a dictionary or a language process to try to reason. So going back to my initial point, is this idea of feeling the interconnectedness of all creation, whether it's human, whether it's rock, whether it's mineral, whether it's ocean, whether it's sky. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things that pointed out straight away was there's no language to accurately describe those states of being. And I think that comes across in many of the spiritual enlightenment teachings, that there's no actual way to translate that experience. You can just point towards it and then you can have a direct experience of it. I think what the beauty about plant medicines and other psychedelics, obviously ayahuasca is our background here. This is the path that we've gone down, one of many paths, not saying one is better than the other, but with that general psychedelic plant teacher experience, specifically plant teachers, it enables you to have a direct experience of something that is not available in day-to-day life, that you don't need to go to a monastery for 10, 15, 20 years or go through countless, you know, I'd even say, because I did a lot of therapy before plant medicines and I didn't get any of those experiences of oneness, but it gives you a glimpse of something that's available. And it's like, what was that? And there's just an absolute knowing that that's the truth. It's not like, you know, I used to take a lot of drugs, and there's like, for me, and I know there's a lot of therapies that go with MDMA and other situations, and there's great connection that's experienced with those people and those situations and parties and stuff. But I'm talking about that direct experience when you experience source and oneness, and there's something in you that is that recognizes that and tells you it's time to wake up. It's like that, even a one experience, in my experience, is a catalyst for a lifetime of seeking that can take you closer to home. So I think I'll pass it back over to you.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. You know, the one thing that I think of, and especially a lot of pushback in a lot of communities, especially in the Buddhist tradition, because a lot of these Buddhist practitioners that are involved with meditation and yoga, a lot of, especially in the West, got their start with these holistic states from these plant medicines. Yeah. And they have used that as an indicator, as a, I guess, as a roadmap or a sign on the path of life that this is the way that they were going to go. And they may not have touched any of these plant teacher medicines in the future, but they continue it through their meditation practice. So, I mean, Michael, when you talk about you can access the divine without having a 10-year dedicated meditation or yoga practice, you know, that's a very valid statement. That's extremely valid. But that I don't want to discount the people that do practice their traditions, especially Absolutely. For 10 years. It's just another method of accessing the divine.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We in one of our group channeling sessions where we did a few group channeling sessions, and we were doing topics around plant medicines and plant medicines as portals for evolution and things like this. And the messages that came through that's always rung true to me, and just to go off what you've said there, Richard, is plant medicines are one technology that's available to us on Earth. Yoga is a technology. Meditation is a technology. The breath is a technology when we know how to access this. And there are many different states and technologies and paths. Definitely don't want to discount any and absolutely value all of those. I'm an avid meditator. I love Qigong, Taoist arts. And for me, they intertwine. And when you go further in one state, if you go further in your meditation practice, that teaches you things that you're able to navigate the plant medicine realm that you wouldn't necessarily be able to navigate if you'd not learned how to do it without it. The past 3 or 4 years of my life have actually been the majority of many parts of that have actually been learning to do and experience the states what have been available to me through plant medicine experiences without it, which has absolutely potentiated those plant medicine experiences. And it's also helped me gain a great awareness of the oneness of the true nature of non-dual reality in my experience. So it's absolutely fascinating. And I also think from the other side of things, sometimes plant medicines can be stigmatized and something that is said is like, well, that's not a true way to access that. So I think the point that I would like to say is that there's many roads home And I think it's up for the individual, whatever that soul blueprint is, whatever is that lock for that key that's going to open and awaken. How can we make that accessible to people? How can we destigmatize it? And how can we make this more of a normalized part of reality, that there are opportunities for people to have these deep healings and awakenings that may not be available through some of these patterns? I know for me, plant medicines, especially at the start of my healing and awakening, were even more important because I wasn't able to access those states because the monkey mind, because of the trauma, because of the thoughts, because of not being able to sit still. So that kind of breakthrough experiences that you can have with plant medicines really like a rocket ship. And I really resonate with what you said there, Richard, where people have these awakening experiences and it takes them on that path. And I've had a few friends that have been like, okay, plant medicines are not for me now. I know this was just leading me to this path. So I think it's beautiful. And I think we should honor all the traditions and how they intertwine and what everyone's interpretation of that works for them.
That's beautiful. That is gorgeous. So maybe this is a nice sequitur into the question that I had for you. Is, would you like to share what your relationship is with Grandma Ayahuasca?
Yeah, sure. The way that we work with ayahuasca, I've studied in the Amazon rainforest in the Shipibo tradition, within the Noyarao lineage of the Shipibo tradition. So the ayahuasca is a portal to connect with other plant teachers, and Noyarao being an enlightened tree with glowing leaves that is a direct access to the divine. And in my experience, the way that it's connected with me is a teacher of non-duality within the plant medicine realm, which is why the work that we do with plant medicines here at Casa Galactica is actually framed as the transition from third to fourth density, which is like, how do we work with plant teachers for the transition to heart-based living, to the unified consciousness, which I think in some levels, in some contexts and some traditions, are still stuck in like lower third density of good versus evil, light versus dark. And that's still valid. And trust me, I've been in plenty of those ceremonies. I've learned a lot of stuff there. But for me, it's been that calling of how do we, and what we've just touched upon, of those traditions, those teachings from the Taoist traditions, from the Buddhist traditions, from the non-dual meditations and all this stuff. Once you start infusing that into the plant medicine world, it's like, okay, there's another level there that's available. There's another level of consciousness that's available. So I first drank ayahuasca in, I believe, 2016. And it was to treat addictions, as we talked about on the podcast last time, Jacob. So it was to treat addictions. And I had a very, very, very deep awakening experience, which then led me to India and Nepal, where I studied yoga and Reiki. And then after that, found my way to Peru to study in the Shipibo tradition in the Amazon rainforest, which I then stayed here, stayed training, stayed studying, and met my wife, who's from Oklahoma. And she was training. We were working, hosting retreats together. And then eventually we broke away and did our own work at Casa Galactica, which is really like our feels like our limitless potential to not necessarily need to fold into any one particular tradition, but take the best parts of everything, which is our own unique expression. So for us, ayahuasca is a great teacher, and also very deeply connected with the Noyarao, with blue lotus, with the eucalyptus trees that are here in the Sacred Valley. But we work with many different plants in many different ways, ayahuasca being one of them. But I think, Just to pull that another level out of that, which is coming through, of one of the most amazing things about the Shipibo tradition and studying the Shipibo tradition is the Shipibo language, which from our viewpoint is a language that was a transmission from extraterrestrial beings given to the Shipibo. This, again, my viewpoint, take it or leave it, that was given from an off world that was left here as a language of the plants that has within it unique codes, like saying like Sanskrit has unique codes within it. But when they're sang in an ayahuasca ceremony, they have a transmission, an energetic transmission that help catalyze people's healing and awakening. And it's the communication with spirit. So we've learned and continue to develop this through our own direct experience of working with those healing technologies without ayahuasca. So we hold ceremonies also without ayahuasca, multidimensional online healing ceremonies, which again comes back to the kind of all here and now Buddhist tradition of everything's awakened and everything's consciousness. So for us, it's really a journey where we go in and out of working with plant medicines, working with plant medicines, working without plant medicines. But the very much the context of our relationship through my own journey of healing trauma, healing sexual abuse, healing violent sexual ritual abuse that was underneath the addictions over the last 5 or 6 years. The set and the context of what we're about and what we feel ayahuasca and the other plant medicines within the tradition that we work with are set with this set and intention of healing and evolving. And it's like very sacred. It's not a journey to go just without respect. It's like we enter into that space to heal and evolve. And then the plant medicines meet us where that is. Sometimes that can be scary. Sometimes that can be frightening. Sometimes it can be beautiful. Sometimes it's all of it simultaneously.
Okay. So man, I could just totally vibe off of a lot of those things. The one thing that comes to my mind, is the story about how ayahuasca was supposedly found. And now a lot of people have their different versions of the story. I know the Shipibo definitely have theirs, because your ayahuasca, and Jake, please stop me if you've heard the story, but it's kind of fascinating because it's actually two plants, Chacruna relief and generally the copy. There are variations because there's a lot of different plants that contain DMT and MEO-I inhibitor, or MEO-I inhibitor. That's like saying ATM machine, regardless. So there is, you have to essentially put two plants together and then boil it for a certain amount of time to get what is considered ayahuasca. And it's fascinating because a lot of the traditions say that the plants themselves taught them how to do this themselves. And it is a fascinating story. It's like, just trying to break down the numbers of it. It's like, what would be the chance or the likelihood of you putting together two different types of things that have to be boiled together for hours on end to get something that is this amazing plant medicine? So you're almost by default have to go with the narrative that they have set. Now, for me, I have a tendency to be very cynical, even though I accept and I've experienced a lot of these higher states of consciousness. But it just goes to show you that there's a reason why a lot of pharmaceutical companies go to the Amazon rainforest to get a lot of their medication. Is because there is a lot of information, there's a lot of wisdom there that has existed for a very long time, and you cannot really get it in a lot of places on the planet. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. So when we talk about these relationships with some of these plant medicines, you know, the other thing that I like to talk about is the sacred reciprocity that exists between us as Westerners going into a sacred space or the villages of these people. So like what can we bring with us to give back to them so we're not just taking? Because as a lot of us know, things like peyote and ayahuasca, there's not enough to go around. So we have to get a little bit creative on how we actually can utilize these substances without necessarily raping the planet. Pun intended on that, because I think that there's a very, very important distinction. When there's things like psilocybe cubensis, which is psilocybin producing mushrooms, that is really my plant teacher. That's where I come from. And all they want to do is share love. It's quite fascinating because in a lot of these psilocybin producing mushrooms, they actually respond to disturbed earth. They follow people around, whether it's in cow pies or disturbed earth. When we, you know, go into a certain area and we dig out a place, they seem to pop up, whether it's in wood chips that we bring in to, you know, urban environments, they seem to pop up. They just want to be loved. They want to be there. There's a reason why psilocybin and especially DMT and then dimethyltryptamine and things like, any of the tryptamine groups, I mean, they're so important to the neurochemical development of the human mind. What do you got?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing I just want to come up with just on to continue on that path, I was just wondering if you'd like to describe a little bit more about your relationship with mushrooms, how that came about and how that's been an integral part of your life.
Oh, that's an interesting story. Thank you for asking me that. I do appreciate that. Mushrooms for me started before I even knew what they were. I had microphobia very early on in my life, like to the point where if I saw a mushroom, I'd walk 5 feet around it. I mean, I was deathly afraid. And I think from a Western context, a lot of Western cultures are mycophilic. Or mycophobic. So for me, in, I guess it would have been in middle school, I started drawing mushrooms on everything and I did not know why. I just knew that there was something innate, that there was a wisdom that I did not necessarily have the words for it. And then I started reading Carl Jung in eighth grade. Shout out to my man, Carl Jung. Yep. So he kind of gave me access to these, this unconscious state of mind that we all hold within us. So in 2003, which I call it the psychedelic summer, I went from being a worthless, no good loser that had no meaning, purpose, or belonging in my life. And over the summer, I had chance encounters with psilocybe cubensis and also LSD, MDMA. And a lot of these substances opened up this door like a key in a lock, as Michael was saying a little while ago. And all of a sudden, I was presented with this world that was not unlike our own, that is... that has potentiality, that shows us that the universe is not necessarily out there, but is also within. As within, so without, as below, above, so below. I mean, that's really the credence over many mystical traditions that have existed on this planet. So for me, I started establishing a relationship with my sacred mushrooms, my relationship with these little cuties that I have found. And I realized that what they were trying to share is, okay, so let me back up. Once they told me, I'll just get kind of woo-woo here for a second. I guess it's a good conversation to have it. But once they told me, I asked them, so why do you folks make psilocybin in the first place? And they told me, because we were bored. So a little cause for pause, as I like to say. So it's psilocybin is so close to serotonin. They're all serotonergic agonists. They all bind to the 2A receptor in our brain. And I think in a way their chat with me about them being bored and just wanted to see what it's almost like they wanted to have a science experiment with the life around them, because you know, we're more closely related to mushrooms than we are to plants. For me, they have their own intelligence. They have their own emotion. They have their own dreams, their own hopes, their own ambitions, much like what we have. And I think it's a beautiful thing to just give them a chance. And now, you know, they're in, you know, phase three trials. And I guess phase two trials. Through Compass Pathways. I mean, in a couple of years, we're going to have, you know, an entire swath of our culture that is going to get a chance to experience those kind of things, much like any other sacred plants that we have.
Beautiful. Well, thanks for sharing. I heard a story from a friend once who's worked a lot with mushrooms. He said something along the lines of that mushrooms consciousness was expanding and they wanted to go out into the cosmos. So they want to help us get there. So it's kind of like that expansion of like, okay, we'll expand our society and then you take us with you because we want to go out too. So I resonated with what you said there about them having their own consciousness and their own intention. That lines up with a few things a few friends have said with mushrooms. I've taken mushrooms quite several times. It's just not my main teacher.
Yeah. I think that's fascinating. Just that you can, everybody has their own teacher. And, you know, variety is the spice of life. And if we all like the same things, the world would be a very boring place. So I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, people get a chance to have their own plant teacher. Everybody gets to have a chance to build their own relationship. And as I think, for me personally, I think it's very important that we build a relationship with these plant teachers before we even consume them, before we need to get to know them. And I think that's part of the preparation, the white coat shamanism, as it's being said, inside of a lab context or inside of the medical or the wellness model. All these white coat shamans, I think it's important that we have these kind of conversations, you know? Mm-hmm.
What do you think is the most important next step for mass access to psilocybin or other plant medicines? What do you think, if there is anything that's kind of like missing from that puzzle piece that could help catalyze that process of it becoming more widely available?
Well, I think from a medical context, everything is going swimmingly. Unlike the 1960s, there's massive amounts of money that is coming into the space. And if anything, that will drive and define what the landscape is going to look like. What's missing? That is something that I've given a lot of thought about. Two things. One thing that is missing is the spiritual component to it, which to give credit to Johns Hopkins University and Roland Griffiths, he really put a lot of emphasis on the mystical aspects or the noetic qualities of psilocybin. So I think the spiritual component needs to be brought to the forefront. It's not for everybody. Just like everything, there is many paths to the one divine. And I'm that's fine. But for the people that do have a spiritual religious bent, I think it's important that we access it based upon the spiritual nature of these holotropic states. The other thing that is missing, I think, is most certainly is the BIPOC community. Black, indigenous, people of color, they need to be consulted and brought into the space. Because right now, all it looks like is just a bunch of white guys, you know, circle jerking, for the lack of better terminology. And that's not right. For mass acceptance, we're going to need to bring in indigenous people that have been working with these kind of things for thousands of years. And that really comes back to this idea of everybody needs to do a little soul searching of what their personal idea and their culture is. Because me, you know, I'm a fifth generation from Ireland. You know, Irish definitely would not agree with me on that I'm Irish, but because they like to make fun of all these Americans that like go, oh, yeah, I'm Irish. I celebrate St. Paddy's Day. But there are also traditions within UK that I've been trying to explore and study. I mean, if for instance, the psilocybe simulansiida is a mushroom that is native to the UK. That usually the harvest time is around Halloween. And there's a lot of schools of thought that believe that Halloween actually grew out of this harvest time for these little tiny mushrooms. So, you know, the blurring between the worlds of the living and the dead, I don't know if it's necessarily true. I don't know if it necessarily has any historical context, but it's kind of fun to imagine, right?
I like it.
So going back to it, I think it really comes back to this idea that there needs to be a lot more investment in the BIPOC community, whether that is community outreach, whether that means BIPOC leadership, whether that means we need to consult indigenous people of America about peyote use, which is a huge problem, especially when we're trying to decriminalize. You pick it. I mean, those are the two big things that I see that wider acceptance is going to kind of bring into the space. What do you think, Michael?
I think just to follow up on that, I think one follow up question I had was like, do you think it's necessary for someone to receive benefit from mushrooms and have be spiritually oriented? Or do you think that there can be just something from people taking that? Because I know people microdose, and there's so many different metaphysical and physical benefits of microdosing mushrooms and being that. Or do you think that the spiritual component will be necessary, or do you think it's going to be something that's more optional?
I think spirituality is something that grows out of the experience.
Yeah, I agree.
It may not be, and I don't think it will be for everybody. Like, I'm a firm believer that in the postmodern claim that reality is subjective. So for me to impose my label of spirituality or nouetic quality on somebody else is not right. I mean, that completely goes against their subjective experience. Now, if they were to participate in some of these plant medicines and they do have these experiences, let them talk about it in their own words, their own subjective experiences. And if it happens to line up with other people and their experiences, so be it. If they want to define it using another word, whether it's through science, whether it's through this, whether it's through that, so be it. As long as we retain the subjective element, I think that I'm okay with that.
Yeah, sounds good. And I think to respond to your other part of the question with regarding to integrating with BIPOC communities in South America, here where I live in Peru, obviously it's kind of like the other way around, where it's been here in the indigenous communities for generations and generations, and obviously there's a massive influx of Westerners that are coming here to in many levels experience, but on the level of our experience here with my wife and I, who spent time in the jungle, became great friends with our teachers, and the message that they have given us, which has been very strong throughout the empowerment teachings that they've done, is like, go and teach, go and share this with people, go and take this out. And it is a recognition that it seems like a mutual recognition that there's people who come and want to have the indigenous experience, which is totally valid, totally brilliant, and totally available. And that also has its pitfalls, as well as then people who are wanting to have an experience, perhaps someone with someone who's perhaps more integrated with their own culture. So I think based upon what you were saying then, if that was to be upon the theory which you have shared, to integrate more of these BIPOC communities, is then having more of those spiritual leaders come forth, or giving access, or being empowered more and more, or given more space to be able to create that. Because I think like you just talked about, that there's a lot of white people who are interested in these because people are relating from a cultural background and it's helping transform that. So I think if that leaks more into some more minority groups and there's more space for that to come forth, then I do think that can also be very beneficial for the absolute level of collective racial trauma and injustice that's gone on this planet, that, you know, let's face it, there's a lot of underprivileged, underrepresented people who need a lot more healing than the average white guy. Not saying that everything's relative and everyone has their own stuff, but the amount of systemic racism that's going through. And I think that's like, and I just see this because I kind of sit there and I've not really been to America. I went once when I was a kid, but I've watched some of the politics and how things have changed and how, you know, over the last couple of years, how it seems like even things have gone even more left and even more right, and there's kind of been even more and more divide. I do really think it's been really interesting, because I can speak about some experiences of ceremonies that I've had in my earlier plant medicine days, where there have been experiences where people have been stereotypically more kind of like right wing, more kind of like prejudiced. And again, a product of their environment, a product of their family, a product of their society, not necessarily putting blame on that. But I've watched the transformation of that happen with people who have had come from a very hard shell, kind of like tough guy, to softening up and finding this level of unconditional love and this connectedness to others and seeing the joy in people's faces as that happened. And then also as well in my own life, seeing where, you know, growing up in a country village in North Wales, where people are quite racist, you know, people don't have opportunity to connect with other people, and seeing how that actually influenced me and my unconscious prejudices, and then the ability to see through those and work through those. So I think in terms of the uniting of communities, the uniting of our societies, I don't think that that level of prejudice can fully exist within the psychedelic space, and that deep level of oneness and awareness, it instantaneously dissolves those things. So I think, to summarize that, for the healing of marginalized communities, I think because of the level of work that plant medicines can do for healing trauma, whether it be personal trauma, familial trauma, ancestral, systemic racism, everything like that we've just mentioned. But I think also that ability for those prejudices, which may form through marginalization, through prejudice, to begin to dissolve, because I think it's like this transition from third to fourth density. It's time for us to step forth together. And I think that that's one of the main roles that plant teachers can have in our society.
Well put. I know that you have a unique relationship with the indigenous people from where you live. What do they want from the rest of the world? If they're giving and providing this wisdom and saying, hey, here, share this with your fellow brothers, because we're all related. What do they want? What do they want us to do for them?
I mean, the first thing I think that many, many indigenous teachers, which I'm aware of here, with absolute respect, are very happy to receive wealth, to be able to have, to be able to build their own. And there's also the very levels of community, it seems to be, that when one of the teachers becomes fairly wealthy, they then take on 20, 30 people. They have so many workers, so many extended family. People live very much month to month here. Very hard hit when the pandemic happened, very hard hit with a lot of the communities that we were involved with, that we were able, thankfully, with a lot of donations from people to help out through that period of time. So I think there's something around that, on some level, putting the indigenous teacher on a pedestal, like that they're necessarily this enlightened being, and then becoming disappointed when they don't exhibit Buddha-like nature. When it's like, yeah, they want to have money. Yeah, they've got unresolved trauma. Yeah, they've got, you know, this, that, and the other. So I would say it's the same as any spiritual teacher. Depending on what that person is like, then it can be a very varying level of experience. I've been fortunately very, very blessed to have a beautifully hot, open teacher called Rona Lopez, who I was very, very lucky to study with for an extended period of time. And what he wanted genuinely in his heart was for me to go out and share that medicine with people, to share the knowledge of the plants that he'd helped me to learn to connect with, and to go out. And I think that there's a level of care and compassion when I've worked with my teachers. And I think this is such a beautiful part of the process, of whilst they're in that ceremony setting. And I think this goes through to any healer in any situation. And it's certainly how we've learned to work, is when you're in that setting, when people come to you to heal, it's like, you're not there, you're out the way. It's like that. We have the saying is the pasajero is primero. So like the participant is first. We always used to say that when we had apprentices and other things, we'd always teach people this. It's like, you're there in service to them, and to see the people tirelessly working to help people heal. And with my teachers, the level of joy that they experience when people start to transform. And I think that's certainly for me in my life, one of the greatest joys of this work is seeing people transform, because they then get access to this magical world of plant medicine, which wouldn't have been available. And I think what's interesting is that the more and more people get to experience that, if it is for you, again, you don't have to experience plant medicines to do this. You don't have to come to the jungle. You don't have to work with an indigenous person. You don't have to do this. Whatever path that is for you, if you're able to experience more of the truth of who you are, I think the world's just going to be a more loving place. And I think that's what really all of us ever want.
No, I absolutely agree. I think that it's important to understand, you know, it makes me think of Jack Kornfield's book, After the Ecstasy of the Laundry. I don't know if that's something that you've ever read. I suggest it. But, and especially in a lot of these traditions, when you reach enlightenment, you get caught up in this trap, or people can get caught up in this trap where they go, well, now I'm an enlightened being, so therefore I'm above everything else. When in all actuality, when you become enlightened, you should be going, well, I, you know, now I have to still carry on my day-to-day lives. I still need money. And you could do the Buddha thing. You could go out in the middle of the forest with no food, no water, no nothing. That's totally fine. But in all actuality, 99% of the time, you still have bills to pay. And I know there's a lot of pushback. I've heard a lot of conversations where people have talked about people in the Amazon River Basin, that people come down for these ayahuasca rituals, and they're like, oh, well, these Kunanderos or Kunanderas or Ayahuascaro or Ayahuascaros, all they want is money. Well, of course they want money. How else are they supposed to survive? I mean, come on, they're thrust into a world that they didn't have a choice in the matter. I mean, they now live in a globalized society. That's globalized capitalism. Of course they want money. Is it everybody wants that? Shouldn't they be comfortable just right along with everybody else? I think it's important to remember that a lot of these enlightened beings are still human. And it's interesting because the people expect, as you were saying, Michael, they expect that you come across this Buddha-like figure in the middle of the forest that speaks in adages and haikus and can touch you and heal all of your woes. But, you know, the real healing comes from within. You're your own personal teacher. The teacher comes from within. Mm-hmm. And, I think that it's also important to consider that once you become enlightened, or once you have these kind of experiences, don't you want to share that with the rest of the world? It's like you're going to just go back to your day-to-day life and not do anything. Why don't you go back to your community and help them? Why don't you spread that wisdom? Doesn't necessarily have to be about that plant teacher. Doesn't necessarily have to be about this substance or that substance. We're all interconnected. We're all one part of this gigantic life form that we call Mother Earth. We're all one part of this gigantic thing that we call the universe, whether you want to call it God, whether you want to call it the continuum, whether you want to call it their interconnectivity. I don't know. You pick a word, it's probably right. But at the end of the day, all people want is to belong, to know that other people care for them. And I think it's so important that we're able to take that wisdom and transfer it to other people.
Beautiful. Well said. I think it's important to also to mention, I think, the difference between the search for enlightenment and working with plant medicines. I certainly believe, and it has been and is our intention, to frame working with ayahuasca and the plant medicines in our healing and evolution retreats here in Peru, that we frame that as the search for the recognition of the truth of who you are. In other words, steps towards enlightenment, steps towards recognized self as a one consciousness. The traditions which I've studied in don't necessarily frame that as the search for one consciousness. Yet the curanderos of the jungle are teachers, absolute magicians of navigating the multidimensional realm, and have such a deep understanding of duality, because I think many of these traditions are, again, third density based framework for multidimensional work, which again is great because you can still do all the healing in the third density realm and do that. but it's very interesting. And I had a very unique relationship with my teacher. Did the more and more that I stepped into the non-dual realms. And I would say to him, I was like, I think this is my experience. And he'd be like, huh? And then he'd have a ceremony and he'd be like, the plants show me this. This is awesome. Let's do this now. So we'd have this like thing and he'd teach me. And he was super open to kind of like discovering more and more about that. So I think like on a larger context, just to kind of like what comes up next is the set and the setting and the intention of what you meet that plant teacher at with will define your level of experience. If you are meeting that with a search for enlightenment, you may find yourself having a really, really dark and troubling experience because it's actually pulling up all the blocks from you that are actually in the way to that. But the set and the setting and the intention, I think that's where the sacredness of this comes. And I think that is what is an important part of that question that we discussed a little bit before about how is that going to be more available to the wider masses. And this, and it kind of ties into the spirituality set part of that segment we discussed, but the intention of what is the intention for us to make these plant medicines more widely available. And I think the third thing that I'd like to add to that, which I think is vital and key to the decriminalization and perhaps legalization of plant medicines in whatever way that rules and regulations want to say that plants are okay. Once we get the okay from everyone that natural plants are okay again. But I think that the important part of that step is the set and the setting. And to go further than that, the level of trauma-informed care that can be provided to someone, at least in the beginning stages of creating a relationship with that plant teacher. Because I'm of the volition that everyone is their own teacher and everyone has their own direct relationship with plants, and they don't need to have a shaman or a curandero or a teacher or a guide when you're able to be your own guide. But I think there's also that level of just recognizing, okay, we're stepping out of the matrix. It's like Neo needed Morpheus for the beginning, right? He didn't just go. He wasn't just like, I'm the one. He's like, let me teach you. He didn't believe it. So then once he had that transition to recognizing and knowing it, I think that's when you start doing your own work. That's when, if you feel like it, you can become someone. If you feel like you're at that of that level of practitioner can begin to provide that in a way that feels in alignment with you. But I think everyone recognizing and putting their hand up and saying, we all need a Morpheus. And like using that Morpheus is not something that is going to be a negative. And it's not something that Morpheus is not going to be the hero. If you look at the movie, you go through it, Morpheus is not the hero of that story. He's one of the amazing characters, but he was the enabler of Neo becoming the one, which I think is what any great teacher should be, is recognizing that everyone is the one and any teacher is only there to reflect that back to you, that you're the one. So I think I'll leave that there.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, you know, it makes me think of, I know the Wachowski sisters, they resist this vehemently, but Matrix actually follows a Gnostic story. I don't know how much you know about Gnostic scripture, because my spiritual leaning is very Gnostic. So you get into this idea of breaking away from the third density into the fourth density and having a teacher to show you that. But as the old adage goes, how does it go? It goes, there's nobody that can teach you anything new. They can only help us to remind us what we always knew. It's been a long time since I've heard that quote. But there is. I mean, it's just access.
Sorry, Richard, could you say that again? Because I think it's an important one.
There is no teacher that can teach us anything new. They can only help us to remind or help to remind us what we always knew. Wow, I stumbled over that.
It's beautiful.
It's been a while.
Could that be taken as like a past life, maybe? I mean, I got a bunch of theories in my head about this too. But
sure, Jake. Sure, please. What are your thoughts?
Okay, well, you know, like for those who believe in the afterlife, right, that we're spiritual beings, and that obviously there's like a heaven in this scenario, but then these spirits, when they're in heaven, they come back to Earth, because a lot of times people, or there's a theory that Earth is more just of our Earth school, where again we get put into these bodies to again learn from previous life mistakes to take us to a higher being or a higher dimension. So we are spirit, and heaven is like the home. And again, we go through difficulties as human beings on this earth because it's like a school to help us transcend to the next dimension.
Wow. There's a lot of systems of belief that believe just exactly that. Mm-hmm. Whether you believe in actual physical reincarnation, whether you believe heaven is a place that you go to that's on a cloud, whether you believe that heaven is a metacosmic existential void that resembles the womb, that is warm and dark and comforting and inviting, whether we come back to learn past mistakes that we have made in previous lifetimes, or you believe that since we're all interconnected, we all have access to all of the past life. I mean, that's theology. Theology has been discussing that for hundreds, if not millions of years, even probably before there was even language. You know, it's an important thing to kind of comes to grips with. And even then, it's like some people just don't care. And that's totally okay, because they live here in the moment.
And I think that comes back to everything, Richard, like you're saying, is that everything's subjective, and it's just any path. So whatever ideology, theology that helps you to have a recognition of, okay, there's something more than this here. There's like that plant striving towards the sunlight, whatever that story, whatever that may be, whether it be something from Buddhism, Tibetanism, or Christianity, or plant spirit, or whatever it may be. It's like that searching, that striving that actually takes us on that path, which is already laid out. So I think it's just, I think that there needs to be more, or there could be more of this less right and wrong in these different ideologies, and just a recognition again of like, oh, great, that's a beautiful path. It's not my path, but that's a beautiful path, you know? And I think we can learn everything from everyone else's path at the same time.
Well, it brings me back to one of my favorite quotes by Carl Jung. He said, good and evil are not absolutes, but man-made judgments depending on culture and religion. Mm-hmm. So this idea of right and wrong, good and evil, although it has its place in a society, because without it, sometimes you would have utter chaos. Maybe not the good and evil part, but right and wrong. Yeah, you have to have some kind of boundaries, because that's what it comes down to, really, mm-hmm. is boundaries. Yeah. But it's like, what really defines that? I mean, of course, we could have an entire podcast just dedicated to that, but... Yeah. But, it's like, how long do we have here?
Well, I think I'm just going to jump on that, right, from in the context of what we've been talking about, because the feeling of the talk of decriminalization comes back to me. And again, there's no right and wrong. There's no right way to do this. But I think that I think from my background, again, being here in Peru, I've studied ancient traditions, and again, taken my own interpretation of that and then found my own truth through that. And working with the trauma-informed care and the channeling and the way that we do, and that being such a very spiritual, you are your own teacher, and these reflections and everything we've just talked about in the last however long. And then there's, as we mentioned as well, there's the kind of like everyone needs, or is beneficial, at least let's say it like that, to have a Morpheus to help you recognize that you're the one. And everyone's going to have a different type of Morpheus. But what I think could be a stumbling block for that decriminalization movement of plant medicines, I think there's two extremes that I want to kind of just like two scenarios, which I don't think either are right, is the one that it just becomes completely deregulated and people go for a free for all and then end up perhaps re-traumatizing themselves, people who are not necessarily at the right time, set and setting, or of the right mental stability, or medication or other things like that, and then end up re-traumatizing themselves and end up worse where they were. No one wants that, not even the person taking that. And on the other side of the set, we have, okay, you have to be a licensed psychologist to be able to administer these medicines, which again is like sucking that, this completely sucking out the spiritual context of that, because that, I don't think that that could be the right set and setting. And I think it's great that we're taking a step forward in that direction. But my question is, and I don't have the answer to this, and I want to bring it up here, is how do we blend spirituality with trauma-informed care, with a decentralization and decriminalization of plant medicines in a way that is going to align with the healing and evolution of the highest good of humanity? And how do we make that happen in the world and the society we live in, where we have rules, regulations, and the whole framework of which our society is built on, which almost seems like it's set up to fail, that hitting it on a mass scale. But again, that concern on one side of it being, okay, it being completely deregulated, and then having a few people perhaps even die, have really negative experiences, that then we go back in the same thing in the war on drugs. See, these things are bad. They're a danger to our children, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do we do that in a moderated way that can actually help us shift from third to fourth density?
I have an answer to that. I'm going to pause this really quick to clear my throat. I'm not going to cough in the mic. Okay. So something that I did talk on one of the, I think it was the last time I was on.
I remember. Today.
I'd like to call it the Trinity of the Psychedelic Renaissance. So the Trinity of the Psychedelic Renaissance is a three-pronged approach to the way psychedelics will be integrated into our society. The first model is the medical model. That will be used to treat DSM-5 problems. That will come by the way of, let's say, MDMA being used to treat people with complex PTSD, like veterans.
Could you clarify the DSM-5, what I think you said?
It's a diagnostic statistical manual for, it's a fifth edition, I suppose. So it's, I bet Jake. <That's bad. laughs> Yeah, he has it. There it is. There it is. You guys may not be able to see it, but Jake, hold it up. So basically it's what is the model in the medical model in our society. So it essentially highlights different conditions that people can be diagnosed with. It was not originally set to be used for insurance purposes, but it is used for insurance purposes. Mm-hmm. So insurance companies are billed because of the diagnoses that they get from either a psychologist or a psychiatrist. So that is one arm. I mean, again, we could talk an hour from that. The second arm is the wellness model. These are retreat centers, similarly to what you offer yourself in Peru. Mm-hmm. But think about it more in North America. There's a lot of places. I know Compass Pathways, Field Trip, a lot of others, a lot of money coming into the business. So they're popping all over North America like mushrooms. So these are more retreat centers that are used as preventative models for a lot of the problems that people face. So you come in, you have yoga, meditation, Reiki, healthy diet, nature work, nature bathing, as it was, I guess that's the word for it now. So that's the wellness model. And then the third arm is what I'm most intrigued by is the spiritual model. This comes by way of like the Native American Church, and the United de Vegetal, there's one more church that comes out of Brazil, and I'm blanking on it. I'm sorry, listeners. Yeah, thank you. Santo Daime. So that's the spiritual aspect. So now we have a triune, we have a trinity of what is actually looking like for what it's going to look like in our society. The problem is, since it has been out of our society since the 60s, there really needs to be a better model of it to be integrated in a society as a whole. So I think that it's important if we just rest on the triune to make sure that we have harm reduction, that there's not going to be a whole lot of issues, And then maybe we can revisit it that 15, 20 years down the line, where it may be part of our culture, similar to the way that cannabis has been implemented in the United States.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for sharing that. I like that. I think it's quite amazing how far and quickly cannabis has spread. And I think from when it first, since it started becoming a thing of like, okay, we're going to decriminalize, and how much of a thing that's come. I think what a transformation we could have if, you know, people started shifting their frustrations with life from drinking alcohol at the weekends to then actually going to a retreat to actually start to see what is it, the root cause of that, and then coming out the other side, like I did, again, very much, for lack of better words, plugged into the matrix, very much unspiritual, unreligious, just wanting to heal addictions, tried something new and came out and had an experience that I wasn't waiting for that set me on a trajectory that I didn't even know existed. Like, if we can start doing that on a mass scale, where people start, rather than running away from their problems with someone holding their hand, start taking steps towards them and recognize that they're not the demons, they're not as scary as you once think they are. Once we start destigmatizing those, once we remove the guilt and the shame from the trauma and the symptoms of that trauma, and we be able to help people to go through that, when people actually start to begin to recognize and realize that, oh, actually, my life's better, my work's better, I'm more prosperous, I'm actually doing things that I love, I have more fulfilling relationships, I actually have a relationship with Earth, I actually start to open to spirituality. These things, and I talked about, funny that I also talked on with Jacob on our last episode about the three things, like I would say a trinity for anything, what's missing or what is part of the problem with addiction is the missing of connection with the Earth, connection with other human beings, and then connection with a higher power or a spiritual aspect. So I think it's interesting how perhaps that once we start to address that, and I think from going to an ayahuasca retreat, you're drinking a plant medicine, so automatically, whether you're aware of it or not, you're having a deeper relationship with the Earth, because you're drinking something that's come from the Earth, that has the spirit of Earth within it. And then if you're in a group setting, you're naturally going to end up having an awareness on some level, whether it just be an open conversation or even more of a direct experience of the oneness of things, or even if it's just inhibitions, and not inhibitions like when you're drinking alcohol and you want to like take your shirt off and run around the parking lot, like mm-hmm. the inhibitions like that you might actually want to be vulnerable and talk about a trauma. There's a big difference there. And then naturally after that, you're starting to have that experience of that spirituality in a way that's not like going to church when someone's saying like, repent your sins and you're going to go to heaven. I mean, again, if that's a path that's beneficial for someone, again, not one to knock that, but it's someone telling you something that you should do in order to have a relationship with God. And that's not how it works in my experience. The plants are here to show you that you already have that. And once you recognize that you already have that, all the things in your life that have told you that you are separate start to crumble. And I think that's a cascading power that's unstoppable. And if we can allow that and help society to access that, I think that we'll have deep life transformation on a mass scale.
No, you bring up the experience of the divine, especially within the religious context, which I think for me personally, and it's one of my favorite things to talk about, is I think that there's a very specific reason why people are leaving organized religion in droves, is because organized religion doesn't typically, I'm not going to generalize here, but typically does not allow you to have experience with the divine. You go to a place where the person tells you what you need to believe, that tells you you need to read this book, and then don't question it. Because if you question it, then you go against the faith that they have determined that is right. And I think it's important that we have, if we had a place that we could go, that we had a direct experience with the divine, I think that's the wave of the future. That's what people need. That's what it takes to build, again, and I'm sounding like a broken record here, so I'm sorry, but meaning, purpose, belonging. You have to have meaning and purpose and belonging. And you find all of those things within that context. It's so vitally important. And I think that's the wave of the future. And I think that in a lot of ways, psychedelics are going to have a hand in that.
Yeah, and I think just to go off that is, and I know this is definitely my own personal experience, that the way that the religious society and community, again, I don't think we need to say any more disclaimers about, like, if that is your path and you have a good experience and that is your part of healing, then great. But my own personal experience was that there was these rules, and I always didn't like rules, ask anyone. I was always kind of like, didn't like to be restricted, but there's this kind of way of doing things that I think in many senses turns people away from religion. Turns people away as something that's boring, something that's limiting, something that's old-fashioned. And I think it's also great if we talk about the psychedelic renaissance. I think psychedelics are the complete opposite of that. They're the complete opposite, and it's so powerful and direct that, again, and I'll be my own broken record, in the right set and setting, that can create spiritual, powerful, life transformative experiences. Going back to those people who were just drank the plant medicines once, and that set them on a path that opened them out. They just got out of the matrix and they found their own path, like Neo did. However that is, I think it's the question is, we already know the answer to this, why the governments have regulated this, because on a mass scale, it's not profitable for everybody to wake up. It's not profitable for everybody to do that in that way.
Well, and if you also follow Dr. Carl Hart's point of view on the thing, it's also is a tool to keep BIPOC communities down and in control. I think that's another thing. I mean, if you really look at it, most regulations, drug regulations, were racist from their inception. It's a way, I mean, in the 60s, it was used to curb the anti-war movement. It was used to curb the blacks, quote unquote, and it was used to curb the hippies. And like you said, how would these people become functioning members of society, in their words, if all they're wanting to do is turn on, turn in, drop out? I mean, even though Timothy Leary used that, he was more of a comedian than anything else. But I mean, it became a huge target. I mean, just for specifically that reason, in of a nutshell. So it's this experience. And then you look back on it, it's like all of the major world religions started from a holotropic state. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of it started from this revelation. And who knows if those revelations were something that they did because under the effects of meditation, or they had a kundalini experience or kundalini awakening, or they had a psychedelic experience. There's a large amount of the population that, well, I wouldn't say a large amount. There's a minority of the population that believed that Moses and the burning bush, that was the acacia, which is one of the highest concentrations of DMT. I mean, in the Bible, they talk about tending the acacia trees. Wouldn't that be kind of interesting if we found out that the whole root of the Abrahamic faiths came from this idea of DMT containing plants?
And then you go even further than that. Yeah, if you go even further than that, you can look at, and we've seen this before and felt this before, when you look at Jesus going into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights, being very, very similar to the traditional Shipibo plant theaters, where you go into isolation and you communicate with spirit, very similar to the Native American vision quest, very, very, very similar to the kind of the Indian going into the ashram, these experiences to have that deep connection. And I think that that's just been like, it's been such a powerful revelation going into that isolation period, because it's so interesting how much we do to prevent ourselves from having true isolation. There's a difference, I think, between being alone and kind of being on YouTube and on the internet and whatever, things like that. But then like taking all that away and then really being there on yourself. And it's scary. It's tough the first time. It's tough every time you do it, I think, on some level, but it's like how much we've avoided that as a society. And you can look at all of those, the ancient religious traditions, how much of a part of that is. And my wife said something, she had a meditation the other day, and she recognized that when she felt alone, she was closest to God. That was a coming through, that the more the alone was actually her being the closest to God.
You must also know my wife. She has a yoga and a meditation practice herself. So she it talks about that. Well, and it's funny you mention that, because in Realm of the Hungry Ghosts, Gabor Mate, going back to that, he talks about like what is the foundation of boredom, is the inability to deal with yourself. It's the anxiety that is produced when you're faced with nothing but yourself. Is that loneliness or is that isolation? And again, as you said, Michael, it really is. I mean, there's a whole swath of mystical traditions around this planet that is based upon that premise of you sit and you be isolated, not necessarily, well, alone with yourself. And if you're alone with yourself, you're alone with the universe. It's just fascinating, fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it's like aloneness or all oneness. I saw that somewhere once. Which one is it?
Well, maybe a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you, because I know that Richard and I have been talking a lot about different plant medicines, and I know we both talked with you individually together as well. And yeah. I know that you've also stated that you're someone who's interested in plant medicines. So I think it was just feels interesting to ask any of the questions that may be coming up from you, from someone who's kind of maybe still sat on the other side of the fence, maybe feeling a little bit more drawn towards it. I'm just wondering if there's anything that comes up for you, potentially fears or interests or things, anything that you feel like you'd like to share or ask.
Yes. Yes. And yeah, thank you for asking. I'm not sure if I talked to Richard about this. I know I talked to one of my other podcast guests about this too. Well, the one fear is more just like, what's my mindset going to be like if I try something like LSD or whatever, because I don't know if it's ignorance, but it's like, you hear horror stories, not a lot, but you hear sometimes when people take a certain drug like that, they never come down and they're in a fear high for the rest of their lives. Again, that's could be a complete lie or whatnot. So that fear is kind of always stuck in with me, even though when I talk to many people, they're like, there's like no chance of that happening. And another thing is, I was going to ask this question too. What would you say to someone like me too? They go in there and right, they have like already set goals prior to even coming to like you guys about doing this. Like, hey, I want to heal my trauma and I want to get one with my spirituality. Would you tell someone like me, like, don't try to force anything, don't have a particular mindset? Or would you say like, just go with the flow? I mean,
Michael, do you want to take one question? I'll take another.
Yeah, sure. I'll talk about the first part. Yeah. And yeah, and feel, Richard, please feel free to add in your own flavor or whatever you feel like on top of this. But the first point, the recognition here, and I've alluded to it several times with regards to trauma-informed care and a level of safety and awareness of people. You know, for instance, if someone has a deep level of mental illness or schizophrenia, then one may be more susceptible to having a psychotic break because of a pre-existing condition. And again, I've also worked with people who have been on antidepressants, have been bipolar, and have had mental conditions, where I've worked with them in a set and setting through our online trauma healing work and spiritual work and channeling and other ways for a period of time until they were actually able to be more within their body, and then started working them with a small amount of ayahuasca and then built that up. And then they've been able to be fine. And that's been a part of that process. So again, I don't think it's a hard yes or a no to someone. And it's, we always take people on an individual setting, but the importance of having a health and wellness screening, of the help, the importance of having a background, the importance of making sure that, you know, if someone's taking other MAOI inhibitors, which, or SSRI inhibitors, it can be lethal, and it can cause trauma and even death in some circumstances. So to have a level of fear about plant medicines is not unhealthy in the sense. It's just, I could relabel it perhaps as an awareness that this is something serious to take. Just like if you were going to go and do skydiving, you would make sure you had a parachute on, and you'd make sure that you were there with someone who knew how to do this. And again, just to use that analogy that comes through, eventually you might feel safe going skydiving on your own, but for the first 100 jumps, you're probably going to go with someone who knows what to do if something goes wrong. So I think that just finding whoever that may be, who is trusted in your own community or with us or with someone else or whoever you feel like that is, that can take you through that process and has a strong movement towards healthcare, safety, wellness, and isn't afraid to say, hey, this is not the right medicine for you right now. And this is not about discrimination. This is just for your own health, safety, and wellness. Just like if someone had a broken arm, I wouldn't say go swimming, because that would be difficult. That could be dangerous, you know? So I think it's just looking at that. And then whoever, you know, and I just want to say this out to the wider space, because I know there's a lot of people who will be able to have access to people working with people who in psychedelic spaces, is do your due diligence. Do your due diligence. I'm just going to use the skydiving analogy. You may say, okay, where did you learn skydiving? Do you know first aid? How many times have you been jumping out of a plane? What should I expect? You know, do we have a medical check or anything like that? Okay, you know, this type of thing. And the same in a psychedelic space, is you can ask people, okay, what's your experience? You know, do you have any, you know, if things do unfortunately go wrong, what would we do? Okay, yeah, we know we have emergency protocols, this, that, and that. We've got your emergency contact. You know, everything should be fine, whatever it is, but you want to go and do your due diligence. Just like if you were going to get in a car with someone, you wouldn't get in a car with someone who didn't necessarily it wasn't qualified to drive that car, because it could put you at risk. And again, eventually you can ride your own car, but it's just do that due diligence and don't let anyone tell you that you're safe if you don't feel it. So people can create that safe setting in that environment. Like, we'll show how safe our work is, but it's up to you to decide, because ultimately it's you that decides to go on that journey. It's you that puts in that situation. Ultimately, the responsibility becomes upon you if you decide to go on that journey. And that involves putting trust and care in someone, which is a big thing to do. It's a big thing to do. So make sure that you put that trust in well-deserved spaces. And I think then, also, as those fears come up, acknowledge each one of those fears. Don't bypass them. Investigate them. See where they're coming from. Talk about that with that professional who's about to take you on that journey. And then once you've had the questions answered about where those fears have come from, then take a decision on how you want to engage with that individual, that substance, that plant medicine, that setting.
Thank you.
Wow. You pretty much covered all the bases, Michael. I don't know how much I can add to that. I guess my thing is, and I just a disclaimer, folks, Michael did not pay me for this, but his website is absolutely gorgeous. And I know how much ayahuasca retreats are, and his retreat is probably a third, if not a half, of some of the other ones that I've seen. So if you guys haven't checked it out, you probably want to check it out. So anyway, the whole intention is important, but you have to understand that when you set an intention before that, when you start, but you let that intention go, because whatever substance you take, it is going to take you to a place that you may not have control over. And this brings back this whole idea of the bad trip. Everybody's heard about the bad trip, right? Bad trip really is just a difficult experience. Bad trips / difficult experiences are actually important, because difficult experiences allow you to confront things that you otherwise would remain stuck in the unconscious mind. So it's... the experience itself is very important, but what comes after it, an integration, that also is another half of the component that you really need to pay attention to, because that allows you to take the difficult experiences that you have inside of the psychedelic holotropic state and integrate it into your life. And sometimes integration can take a day. Sometimes it can take a week. Sometimes it can take an entire year or an entire lifetime to try to make heads or tails of what actually happened. But it's just going back to something you said, Jake, a lot of the stuff that came out of the 60s saying that LSD will do chromosomal damage, I think that we've talked about it previously, a lot of that's bull. However, there people that do have pre-existing health conditions that can spark a lot of problems, a lot of mental breaks. So the screening process, just like preparation and integration, is very, very, very important.
That's beautiful. So I have another thing to ask. So let's say somebody wants to get rid of their trauma or their PTSD. Again, would you tell them to, again, look at it differently, or just let them know, hey, this may not cure everything the first time, but maybe it'll help you manage those, like, let's say PTSD-related symptoms better after the first time and so forth?
Can I just follow off what Richard said? And, yeah. And I just wanted to, and I think something will segue into that. Is that okay with you, Richard?
Right ahead.
Yeah, I think what you were saying about the bad trip was something interesting. And I think the way that also come into the safety and the setting. If you have support around you through that challenging and difficult experience, it can reframe a negative psychedelic experience to a positive healing experience. And many of these, I would just say, they use the same word, bad trips or tough experiences in the psychedelic space, often is unprocessed, unresolved trauma coming to the surface, which we had to deal with on our own. And I think on some level, the very definition of trauma can be a negative experience that we were unable to process, and we were often left on our own through that. If someone was there to help you through that someone who was being abused, who then stopped the abuse, took you to a therapist and helped you work through that at a young age, you may not have residual trauma or trauma that stays around from that. So to go back to that bad trip experience, why the negative experiences can and are so incredibly powerful in the right set and setting in the trauma-informed environment is that if you have one of those negative experiences that I've just said, that you had to you weren't able to process on your own, you were left on your own, and it becomes stored, repressed trauma in the body. When you're able to experience that in a way that you're held safely, you're able to reframe that and heal trauma at the root cause so that that unconscious trauma doesn't manifest in your life. So that's that. When you have that in that situation, this is what trauma-informed care is about, is recognizing that everyone could have a negative experience. And I'm saying, I don't think it's a negative experience, because myself, and when you've worked through those experiences and you've been held through that process, on the other side of it, there's a great sense of relief. There's a great sense of transformation. And again, it might not be the same night. It might not be the next morning. It might be a few days, a week, or even a month later, whatever it is. So I think that's the first part to say that. And then just to move into, Jacob, what you were saying about with trauma, could you just repeat that question?
Yeah, and I want to reframe back to what you said too. In a sense, you're always kind of dealing with your trauma, PTSD, but when you go through this process, you're just dealing with it in a different, maybe more healthier way, in a sense.
You're unable to escape it, because the process, I mean, if you're going off of just psychoanalytic theory, mm-hmm. is that you're continually repressing a certain amount of trauma that manifests itself and somatic experiences throughout the body, whether it's anxiety, depression, jitteriness, ADHD, the list goes on and on. So under the effects of, you know, most of the traditional psychedelics and also MDMA, you're unable to escape it. It just all bubbles to the surface, and then you're left dealing with it. So it's important, as Michael was talking about, you need a container to deal with it inside of. And then, you know, not to go back into it, but something that was talked a while ago, I think Michael was touching on, that's a problem that will happen in society if these things aren't effectively taken care of, is that you're going to have a lot of people that are going to take this in the wrong set and setting, and they're going to re-traumatize themselves. And then that's going to be a problem. So now going back to what you're saying is that you were viscerally connected to your trauma, experiencing it in synesthesia. And when I don't know if you know what synesthesia is, but you hear smells, taste, sounds. It also is internal. So you have this entire internal world that kind of bubbles up onto the surface that you have to deal with. And it's just important to have a container to deal with it in.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. No, that that pretty much answers my question, you know. And again, and it reminds me too about what this counselor said a long time ago too. You know, back in the 70s and 80s of therapy, when it comes to old school anger management, that the old style would be like yelling, screaming, get the trauma out, get it out, when they've proven that that's actually not very helpful. That's not really solving a lot, right?
Kind of. Yeah, there actually is. There's branches of therapy, screen therapy, that allows you to unleash a lot of those traumas in somatic ways. So I know, especially in Gestalt therapy, Fritz Perls was very big on that. He would often ask somebody, how are you feeling? I'm feeling mad. Well, show me. And the person would, I'm feeling mad. Well, louder. I'm feeling mad. And, you know, it continually gets higher and higher until because it's important that you allow the trauma to take its course. Okay. Bessel van der Kolk talks a lot about this. It's important for your sympathetic response, the fear, the, you know, fight or flight response, to take its course. And sometimes you have to let it come out in that sort of way to ground that somatic reaction into the feeling or the trauma that you're experiencing. And then if you're ever in a psychedelic space, it is magnified 1,000-fold. You can't hide. Everything comes up. I know I'm beating a dead horse here, but you're confronted by your shadow. Your shadow is right there by your side. It's either you try to push away your shadow or you try to integrate your shadow. That's why it's very important to trust, surrender, and let go to some of the more difficult challenges. That's a mantra in a lot of psychedelic circles. So people are having very intense, very negative reactions that you sit with them and just trust and let go. Trust and let go. Let it bubble up and let it come out, and then embrace what it is. Become curious. Become curious. Ask that shadow part of yourself what it wants, what it needs. Just be curious.
Yeah. Just, I think just to follow on from that. And I think that's that beautiful, that surrender of just inviting that surrender. And again, the analogy that comes forth is kind of like, if you were going to go in a car and you were with kind of like Michael Schumacher and he was driving the car and he was going fast or whatever. And you'd be like, okay, this is Michael Schumacher. I'm going to surrender. I'm going to try.
How did you put Michael Schumacher into this conversation? That was brilliant, Michael. That was brilliant.
Well, I watched the Michael Schumacher documentary like a few months ago. I highly recommend it if you've not seen it. It was a beautiful homage to his professional career and his life. But if Michael Schumacher is here with us anyway for this psychedelic journey, and so you can trust and you can surrender to him or some level of high-level athlete or driver that's there, and you're able to say, okay, I'm going to surrender to this. And then compare that to how you might, you know, be able to surrender towards like a learner driver or even someone who was driving drunk. So there's the whole point of like physical, mental, emotional, spiritual safety, which we've talked about, but there's a deeper component to that. When you feel and you know through the integrity of the people that you're working with, that safety is inherent and you're like, I trust these people. When you have that difficult experience, it enables you to let go more because you're able to, and it's like that when you're in a relationship, if you get into a relationship and you begin to trust that person or you trust that friendship group or whatever it is, you're able to open and let go more because you trust that you're going to be held in that space. So that setting, that safety is also paramount in the ability, the amount it's influential in assisting you in surrendering. Just like if you were, you know, when you're kind of doing those trust exercises, when you kind of fall back, you're able to fall back because you know someone's going to catch you. But even when you do that, that first bit's scary, right?
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit like with plant medicines. When you've taken that, you're falling backwards. You're not going back so quickly to standing up. You're going to fall back and you have to trust that whatever's there is gonna catch you, and ultimately, beyond all of it, you're always gonna be okay. In the inevitable spiritual realm of all infinite things, you're gonna be fine. But it's very important to have that relative safety that can enable you to be able to let go.
You're falling back. Trust falling into the fifth dimension. You fall back and you disappear. Jake, I wish I could. I was better at words, so I could describe to you some of these kind of experiences. It's just something that you may have to find for yourself on that spiritual journey through life, right?
Yeah, maybe I will in the near future someday.
I know. If only we knew somebody that had a retreat center that specialized in these sort of things. I don't know. Maybe if we put our heads together, we could think of somebody.
CasaGalactica.com, everybody.
There you go. Nice plug.
Couldn't resist.
So another thing that I wanted to transition to. So for all the listeners that may not know, so when y'all say dimension or density, do you mean dimensions of the human consciousness? Or
in some circles, it can be synonymous. Some circles, it isn't. One of the biggest, I guess the only thing I can do is give anecdotal story, a short story, because of course I'm terrible at telling stories, so I'll just try. So one of my first experience with a plant teacher, I was shown different vibrations of the universe. Okay. I actually have it. It's around here somewhere. I drew it on a post-it note. And I was shown how everything in the universe was just different, heavier or lighter vibrations of everything else. So if you imagine the entire universe as strings on a guitar, you pluck that string hard and it vibrates. Now you have matter. If it gets smaller, now you have feelings and emotion. It's smaller than that. Now you just have atoms. I don't even remember. It's been a long time since I've had that. But I guess really what it comes down to is there is a density that exists in the universe, whether you're talking metaphysics, whether you're talking about regular physics, because they're constantly fighting with each other. But what really comes down to it, going back to the whole postmodern idea, is when you're in these kind of experiences, it makes sense. You just see it. You experience it. It's different than just trying to describe it to somebody else. So when you experience, whether it's true or not, it doesn't matter, because in the subjective experience, everything's true.
From the perspective of where I'm talking about densities, you'll often hear me say transition from third to fourth density. I talk about it like that because that is the journey which I'm going through, that we're going through, that it feels like is the most important journey for us to be taking at this moment collectively and individually. This is, again, my perspective. But the transition from third to fourth density, the third density being the density of self, and then the fourth density being the density of love. And if you can kind of think of the fourth density energy of being Christ consciousness, and again, not necessarily with the religious context, but it can be with the religious context, that kind of the Christ consciousness and whatever the connotations that has for you, the transition from that separate self to that unified self, what we've talked about so much in this podcast already, about the interconnection of human nature, of humans, of the earth, of rocks, of beingness, is how do we recognize ourselves as an interconnected species, a consciousness, and move beyond the third density experience, which is the human experience, with third density consciousness going to fourth density consciousness. And below that, you can see second density as animal consciousness. So then you can see that transition from an animal consciousness to from second density to third density is then the awareness of self. The human has the awareness of self. An animal, for the most part, it would say, doesn't necessarily have the awareness of itself as a conscious being necessarily. And then the third density consciousness has the recognition of self, which is very much based within the ego, very much based within separation, fear, and survival. And then the fourth density is then the dissolution of those boundaries of self, while still recognizing yourself as an individuated consciousness, but it's the movement into more of a collective consciousness. It's a movement into a more unified consciousness would probably be a better way of doing that. So that another way to say it would be also, how do we move to more heart-centered, unconditional loving and living? That's what feels like is the priority for me and the work that we do at the moment. And that's how we frame a lot of our work. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm discussing densities.
You can relate it to Jung's concept of the 3+1 principle. He talks about the conscious, the subconscious, and you know, the unconscious, plus the collective unconscious, which would be the fourth. So we saw it as symbols. So like in dreams, it was particularly important. So if you saw three or four, you see a box. So you see something that is unified in the collective unconscious of the mind. So the collective unconscious is shared amongst everything else in the universe. So if you look at, like, if you draw a star, for instance, and then you cut off the tips of the star, and then you take the tips of the star and say, well, those are individual people, whereas the interior of that star diagram would be the totality of the universe. Talked about like archaic and esoteric and alchemical traditions throughout the universe, which I know that you have a lot of symbols on your website there, Michael. So mm-hmm. like fourth dimensional tesseracts and but yes, you under certain holotropic states, you don't even see, but you experience some fourth dimensional objects that may or may not necessarily relate to densities. So this is where we go back to the whole thing in the very beginning about needing a whole entire vocabulary to describe some of these states.
Thanks for sharing all that, Richard.
Well, thank you for sharing. It's been a very enlightening conversation.
Yes, beautiful. I've enjoyed it a lot. Thanks so much.
So what did you talk about, like, Richard, about 11 dimensions earlier on? And we don't need to get too far into it, of course. But
That's more of the physics. So physics, there's a lot of realms of physics and quantum physics, and I am no physicist, and nor am I a quantum physicist. But in a lot of physics circles, they believe that there is 11 or more dimensions. So okay. I don't know if you guys have ever seen Carl Sagan's The Flatlanders. Ever see that? So he talks about imaginary family that lives in two dimensions. And then they experience a three-dimensional object. And then the only way that they can experience that three-dimensional object is the shadow that is cast into two dimensions. So you got length, width, height, three dimensions, plus time. And then it just keeps expanding out. And this is that, you know, that's beyond my pay grade. But a lot of physicists believe that there's 11 or more dimensions out there that can or cannot be superimposed on some metaphysical concepts that is shared from esoteric or alchemical traditions. I don't know if that answers your question, Jake. I really don't. I'm sorry.
No, it's good. I think they say that too, as us as human beings right now, we're currently in the third or fourth dimension.
Right.
Per se. Well,
it depends on if you can classify time as a dimension or not. Time is more of a movement through three dimensions. So I don't think they classify as a time. Please, listeners, if you have a degree in physics, please comment and correct me, because I know that I'm totally just butchering this.
I would say to anyone, again, I'm not an expert on dimensions and densities, but the definitive guide from my experience is the channeled book called Ra, The Law of One, channeled by Carla Ruckert. And this goes very, very deep into it, into the metaphysics, into the physics of it. And if anyone is wanting to go deeper into consciousness expansion, it's a tough read. I've not read the whole thing myself. I've read parts of it and bits of it. Many people also break things down on videos and YouTube. But if you want to start looking at the level of densities of where we're going, as I've discussed, from third to fourth density and why that's important and how that is the part of the path of our own healing and evolution, check out that book, and that will keep you busy for the next 10 years or longer.
It is a brilliant book. And I just disclaimer, because I know that a lot of your audience is very much based in the wellness and medical model. So this may come across as a lot of woo-woo, but I think woo-woo is important because it allows us to grow. Without woo-woo, we wouldn't necessarily have science. Because if you remember, science grew out of alchemy. I mean, it's the pursuit of things that is unknown. So a lot of these channeled works, you know, you talk about the law of one. One that I'll throw my hat in the ring is for Edgar Cayce, who also was a great channeler in the early 20th century. Fascinating fellow. Complete works of Edgar Cayce, also talking about densities and past lives. And oh man, yeah, that's, should we just have another podcast episode just for the woo-woo?
We could go for ages of that.
I think for the nature of this podcast, to anyone who's just like got a little lost and like, what are these guys talking about? Just to bring it back in terms of like what I was saying about the transition from third to fourth density. I think if you want to just, in my experience, if you wanted to take a few things like grounded practical steps away from that, here's some great questions that you can ask yourself. One, where am I abandoning myself? If you ask that question, where am I abandoning myself? That can be in work, in life, relationships, in love, wherever that is. That is a great way for you to start discovering more of the truth of who you are. Because if you have that deep heart question, where am I abandoning myself? That will also show you a little bit more of that path. The second thing that I would say is a very grounded and practical way to start beginning to follow that path is beginning to wholeheartedly and audaciously beginning to follow your joy and your passion in life without any expectation of what that's going to look like. Just start following that path, because doors will open along the way of that path of joy and excitement. And then what we've been talking about here as well today is trust yourself, because that's what you're your own teacher, your own path will develop. And that transition in your own life to more heart-centered consciousness and awareness will come from you beginning to believe in yourself. So whatever it is, whatever job you're doing, whatever walk of life you're from, whatever it is, whether you're a scientist or a robotics technician through to in the wellness or an athlete or whatever it may be, begin to trust yourself that expression of your unique divine creation is the most important thing that you can do.
Really said.
A way to ground it. Way to take it way out in the universe and bring it squarely right back down to the ground. That was brilliant, Michael. Nice nice caveat.
And then so read the lower one.
Oh, that was awesome. So before we close things up, to end with a little fun, Star Trek. Was there anything you wanted to read prior?
Okay, let's do that. Just.
Well, I've been a Trekkie all my life. Next Generation, Michael, I don't know how old you are. I'm 40. I was pretty much born into Star Trek. Star Trek is, me and my wife were brought together by Star Trek. The new Star Trek, I really love the direction that Star Trek is going. CBS has kind of now made a whole Star Trek universe complete with Discovery and Picard and Lower Decks. Right. And Brave New World, or
Strange New Worlds.
Strange New. Where I was like, wait a minute, why am I? Thank you. It's like, that's Aldous Huxley. Wow, I totally blanked on it. But Star Trek's fascinating because in a lot of ways, Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, he kind of was a modern prophet, or at least was able to read the spirit of the times. So, and he was, you know, one of the first progressives in TV. And a lot of people don't realize that Lucille Ball, if it wasn't for Lucille Ball, we wouldn't have Star Trek. She funded Star Trek in the background at a time where women didn't have a whole lot of power in Hollywood. She used all of her power because she believed in Gene Roddenberry's product that he was bringing in. Was the first interracial kiss. You know, the new Discovery, they highlighted non-binary, you know, in a lot of ways in Discovery, they have a gay relationship between two of the members on board that wasn't, their identity was not necessarily based on the fact that they were gay. And I think it was genuine and beautiful. I mean, I could talk about it forever.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, everything Richard said. And I think what the beauty about Star Trek is that it's so inclusive, and it's like, it builds the inclusivity within the shows of everything from non-binary, race, sexuality, gender, everything. And then it almost shows us a blueprint of how we can build that and go out to the galaxy. Like, if there was a blueprint to follow, like, I think like the Star Trek is a pretty great blueprint of, you know, of like the first directives and being, you know, helping other people and being, you know, heart-centered and living. I think it's just like so great how that's there. And I think it's just such a stark contrast. And I talked about this in the podcast the other day of like the stark contrast between like probably the majority of extraterrestrial movies being depicted as malevolent races that are here to destroy the Earth, which is not the truth. Right. It is not the truth. And that's what I think Star Trek is so beautiful, because you watch Star Trek and I just have tears in my eyes when I'm watching all of these like heart centered. I don't know if you've been watching the Strange New Worlds one on Paramount that's been coming out. And I was just like, man, when they were kind of like out there playing the music and it was connecting, and it's just like this opportunity for love to be shared. And I just think I've not been myself as much of an old Star Trek fan. I've definitely watched it as a kid, and I definitely remember it, and I definitely think it was awesome with Data and Picard and everything. Yeah. But I thought that Discovery was a really like bold move forward to not redo what's been done, but to appeal to another generation of people and find a way to promote inclusivity, of diversity, of openness. And I think it's just so rare to find that in TV shows these days that actually is exciting. And also looks at the time travel, different dimensions, you know, like the mycelial network, traveling the mycelial network in Discovery is genius. For anyone who doesn't know, that is traveling the mushroom network through space to be able to beat warp speed. I mean, it's just like, that's just awesome. You know, I just like hats off to them. I've had a little trouble with this. I tried to watch the second season of Picard and I wasn't into it. I was just like, it felt a little bit like it wasn't at the same level of Discovery and Strange New Worlds, but Discovery, Strange New Worlds and Picard season one, I've absolutely loved.
Oh man. Yeah. You have to, there's a lot of fanfare. No spoilers here. The end of Picard season two is genius. I wish I could talk more about it. Well, you know, it's interesting because yes, in a way Discovery was kind of appealing to a broader base, but you always have to remember that Star Trek was always progressive. Mm-hmm. It always was doing the next thing. It always was one step above society. And I think it's beautiful to understand that. In fact, what made me fall in love with my wife is I asked her one night, we're both Star Trek nerds. We're both looking up at the stars. And I'm like, well, when you look up at the night sky, what do you see? And she says, potential. Mm-hmm. She says that she sees all of the things that we can become once we get out there. All of these worlds and these stars are waiting for us to go out and explore. And I think that really is what captivates the whole Star Trek persona. You know, it's this magical adventure through the cosmos, through the mycelial network. To the fact they even named one of the characters Paul Stamets, mm-hmm. Who is a master mycologist. Are you familiar with Paul Stamets, the real Paul Stamets?
Yeah, I'm aware, and I thought that reference was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, he took a lot of pride from that. Paul Stamets is a man that is doing a lot of good things for this earth, whether it's educating people about psilocybin producing mushrooms or saving bees with mushroom mycelium, which is another fascinating field of exploration. But, you know, Star Trek, there's always something there to captivate your interest. There's always something there that makes you, that will inspire a new generation to want to go out and explore, that want to go and land on the moon, will land on Mars, go out to the Pleiades. You want to talk about the Pleiadians. I know Michael knows a little bit about that. That's, race. Again,
the alien race. Yeah.
Yeah, the Pleiades are interesting. You look at the Subaru marker, Subaru emblem, that's a Pleiades. That's the Pleiades. I didn't make
that connection. My parents had Subaru cars, when I was growing up.
There you go, buddy. Synchronicity. I found out that shout out to my cousin, he is a video producer in Phoenix. He's really, we were the black sheep of the family. He's like 15 years older than me. But he's really got me into a lot of these frame of minds, these ways of thinking. But the Pleiadians talked about it. Terrence McKenna, he got me into Terrence McKenna when I was, 20, 21. Just keep looking out up at the stars, guys. Keep looking at the stars.
So beautiful. Why is there this such, and I don't want to change subjects too much, but Star Wars. I know there's always a battle between Star Wars and Star Trek. Can you just love both, or can they both have the same meanings, or are they just too different?
It's a bunch of neckbeards sitting around wanting to argue about things that are pointless because they have not necessarily brought meaning, purpose, and belonging in their life. Mm. Luckily, that's a very small minority. A lot of other times, people just like to argue about which is better just because it's fun. Yeah. I like both. But George Lucas, shout out to him because, again, George Lucas took a lot of Gnostic stories and put it in his movies. I mean, it's Gnostic. I'm just trying to think. There was somebody famous wrote a whole treatise on how Star Wars was a Gnostic story, but I digress.
The hero's journey as well, bringing the hero's journey forth. So I think there's just like within Star Wars, again, there's also that light versus dark. There's the hero's journey. I just bring this back to everyone. It's like those Star Trek, the Star Wars, they're just like our words. They're not the truth, but they lead you to have your own direct experience. If whatever you're watching, whether it be a documentary, a movie, or a comedy, or whatever it is, if it's a reflection of you to grow and expand and be more of your own true nature and be intrigued by the expansion of consciousness, then I'm all for it.
No, I agree. I mean, and Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung are smiling from the grave because they kind of brought that hero's journey into the spotlight, like Sauron's eye from Lord of the Rings into society's view. Like everything is the hero's journey. It's one of the prime archetypes.
Beautiful.
Well, I just want to, again, thank you guys so much. It was truly an awesome experience. It really was.
Yeah.
It's a blast, Jake. Thank you.
Yes.
Absolutely. Thanks, Michael. Beautiful.
Yeah, and I really, really appreciate it. And I just want to just say as well to anyone who's interested by any of the work that we offer, check out CasaGalactica.com. If you want to speak to me personally, go ahead and book a free consultation. We have unlimited free 30-minute consultations where we can talk about your own personal circumstances. And then you can also get a whole bunch of free consciousness expansion material, like activating your intuition and fundamentals of trauma healing, just by signing up to our community, and you'll just get all that completely free. No commitment, you just get that. And if you've got any questions, please reach out. And Jacob and Richard, this has been thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyable. For some reason, I feel like I've not even been on Zoom. I feel like we've all been sitting in the same room having this conversation. It's been beautiful. So thank you so much. And thanks to everyone who's listened. It's been a beautiful experience. And thanks for your presence.
Really appreciate it, guys. It's been an absolute joy. It's nice being able to sit down. Michael, I think that you pointed it out. It is. I like this open format conversation. It's like just friends sitting around talking about the universe, life, love, belonging, meaning, purpose. It's all fun. It's all fun. And I'm just going to go ahead and mirror what Michael says. Check out his website. It's pretty awesome.
Thanks, Richard.
And also, Richard has a Facebook page as well.
Yeah, the Lyrian Psychedelic Society. You can definitely find me there. I'm not really engaged on a whole lot of social media because, I think we've already talked about that. But you can reach me. I'm sure it'll be in the show notes where you can find me. I'm around.
Definitely. Awesome. And again, to all my listeners, I'll make sure I put all their links and information on my show notes as well. So. All right. Again, gentlemen, it was a true blessing tonight. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jack.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I again want to thank Richard and Michael for another awesome BHI episode. I just want to inform all my listeners that the information and content expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice or interventions. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health professional. All right, everyone, thank you and have a great day. Bye.